Thank you, Mike. It's always been a pleasure working with you at RCIS. We won't lose track of you, that's for certain. You know, and I usually start out with an economist joke or two, but I've discovered that we don't think they're funny and you don't think they're jokes, so I'm going to dispense with that for the moment. And I'm a little bit appalled having to follow an entertaining and enlightening lawyer. That's not something you usually have to do, so Kurt, you set the bar pretty high there. So, you know, I'm going to approach this very differently. One of the things you often hear from economists is, you know, give me a forecast. You know, that's what a lot of people like economists for, because if the economist gives you a forecast, they will be wrong. You know they're going to be wrong, but then you can blame the economist for not doing what you know you should have done about your business. You know, it's interesting. People ask me, what do you do for a living? And I always say, I teach remedial economics to multimillionaires, okay? I talk to farmers. But it is interesting because think about what we want to talk about today here. I want to talk about anticipation. Anticipation is a very different skill set than forecasting. Forecasting is that worthless activity of saying, on this date in the future, the price of X will be this. Okay? You're going to be wrong. Anticipation is a different skill set. Today, when you heard about the weather and climate, it was very much talking about patterns and anticipation patterns, looking at things. It doesn't always fall exactly like it did in the past, but you should learn from that. Who's familiar with Wayne Gretzky? Anybody remember Wayne Gretzky, all-time leading scorer in hockey, right? Wayne had a famous quote. They asked him, how do you score so many goals? And Wayne Gretzky said, most people skate to where the puck is. I skate to where the puck is going to be. Well, that's a pretty bold statement, right? Unless you're the all-time leading scorer in hockey. Now, my other favorite sports philosopher is Dr. Michael Tyson, the boxer. Remember Dr. Tyson? Yes. Dr. Tyson said, everybody has a plan until I punch them in the face. So let's think about this as a philosophy here. We're here today to think about anticipation of what's going to happen in agriculture. Now, I'm a big systems believer. And systems are about the connections. When you think about a system, we talked about, I went back and looked at my presentation from 2 years ago. It was once again bringing up this topic. What are the interactions that we should be aware of? Because systems are defined by the fact that if you change something, it will influence something else. And that thing that you influence will come back and change the first thing again. There's a feedback loop. And that feedback loop runs. That's the very nature of the cycles. In fact, I'm going to go back to my opening slide. Trend versus cycle. We know that things move in long-term trends over time. Very easy to see. But what mostly drives our success in business is thinking about the trends or the cycles around those trends. So everything's connected, we just don't see how. And you also heard a very important statement today. Straight lines are only for government forecasts. Nothing natural moves in a straight line. So the cycle around that trend is very important to us because it's going to make the difference between being successful and not successful. So agriculture is very much about understanding where you are on the cycle and the trend so you don't make a poor decision. Think about this. It's a very important statement in systems analysis. And so it kind of recapitulates an old saying. It says, it ain't what you don't know, it's what you know that just ain't so. That's where risk comes in. When we think we know something and it's wrong and we make a bet based on it, then we find out we're wrong and there's a panic. Anybody looking at the stock market right today? Anybody check their iPhone stock index? Who's happy about it? Very few people would be happy about all that red. What's been happening so far this year is people are just capitulating on the story of growth around commodities in the world. What happened to our happy landing? So let's talk about this. This is a slide from my last presentation. I brought it back up because it really does talk to why we get blindsided so often. We want to know what's going to happen in our little part of the world. For today, we're going to define agriculture as our little part of the world. We want to know what's going to happen in agriculture. So tell me about agriculture. Give me supply and demand tables. Tell me how much corn there is in the world, and I'll make a decision. Wrong way to look at it. Because agriculture doesn't stand by itself. Agriculture influences the economy, and the economy influences agriculture. There's that feedback loop. What we've done that's different is we connected biofuels to agriculture. Whether you love ethanol or hate ethanol depends on who you are and where you live, right? In Iowa, they always mistake ethanol for Viagra, so that's their problem. But it's interesting that you have this back and forth going on, and we're going to talk about this because 2 years ago, if I had correctly forecasted what's happening today, I would have been insane. The ability, okay, 2 years ago when I was at this meeting, I would have said, we're going to have $28 barrel crude oil in February of 2016. It would have been the wildest bearish forecast out there. But it happened to happen. So think about forecasting and then think about that risk of doing something about it. I'm not going to spend too much time today about the monetary and the fiscal side here. Well, once again, there's a lot of influence going on. You know, whether you're lobbying or whether you're involved in the political process, it's interesting to think about how monetary policy and fiscal policy interact. Nobody wants to be the bad person for policy. Nobody wants to be the adult in the room and say, hey, we got to fix this, and this is what we do. They always want to push it off on somebody else. So monetary policy and fiscal policy look at each other and interact with the economy. This is why you will not predict the future. Let's zoom in on agriculture a little bit. Let's talk about corn. Let's put corn at the center of the world now. So we zoomed in from agriculture to corn. Think about how our loops are running in this world. It's the largest legal cash crop in America, right? We put legal in there to make sure marijuana doesn't take the center of the stage. But what have we done? Livestock, ethanol, protein, and energy. Two largest consumers of corn. Corn is the largest cash crop in the United States. It is the center of all prices for alternative crop prices. If you look, you will see that there's a long-term ratio between all crops and corn that's extremely stable. 2.5 is for soybeans. 1.5 is for wheat. Between corn, soybeans, and wheat, you now have over 75%+ of total crop acreage in the United States taken care of. Two ratios to remember, 2.5 for soybeans, 1.5 for wheat. So where the price of corn goes soybeans, so goes your wheat, so goes your cotton, so goes all the other things that compete on the margin. So you have this incredible dynamic between these things. But think about profitability in agriculture, one of the things we're talking about today. Cash rents, biggest consumer of income from the farm side, and input prices. They interact with prices as well. So let's ask this question. You're going to hear a lot of buzz in the general press. Is there a crisis in agriculture? What we heard in the last couple of days from the USDA's forecast for 2016 is we're going to have even lower net farm income in this year. So is that a crisis? That's an interesting question because all economics are personal. But let's remember that farm accounting is way more of an art than it is a science. Anybody's ever dealt with a farmer and tried to get them to account for their income correctly has pulled their hair out, right? They avoid two things, cash and taxes. But earnings are less, you know, than income. So let's talk about that. Trend and cycle. Maybe we had unreasonable expectations in agriculture over the last 10 years. Think about what we're in. Agriculture is a commodity business. You produce the same commodities as everybody else. What is the defining characteristic of being a commodity business? It's volatile, and it's all about who's the cheapest producer. If you don't want to have to deal with that situation, move out of a commodity business. But commodity businesses are, by their very nature, unpleasant, competitive businesses to be in. What's the saving grace of being a commodity business? It was interesting last year, I had a conversation with one of our dairy operators. He milks over 50,000 cows in his different units. He loves dairy operations. Why? Because he can produce another 100 million, another billion pounds of milk and sell it into the market with nobody's permission. He likes it because he knows he's good at doing it. So commodity businesses have their issues, but they also have their advantages. Is insurance mispriced? That's another question I'd like to ask today. What would I mean by mispriced? Is it disproportionate to what else is happening in the system? Good news is no, it's not mispriced. Insurance is actually about the same as it's been for the last 15 years. And we'll see that. You know, I often say the statistics are just like the busboy at Hooters, right? Why is that? Because nobody looks at him either. So let's start out with some numbers here. We hear a lot about lack of farm income. You know, and we just heard earlier today that farm income is at the lowest level it's been in a decade. What's the good news is look at the revenues. What's most important to the people in this room is that the revenues stay high, because they need to spend a certain percentage of their revenue on inputs, and one of those inputs is crop insurance. The good news that I have is when I look out there and look at the global situation, I don't believe that we're going to see crop values drop dramatically. I don't believe we're going to see livestock values drop dramatically. Right now, they're both around $200 billion, livestock and crop. And that's balanced. Typically, we see there's a one-to-one ratio between crop and livestock over the last 50 years. Now, it can deviate from that significantly year to year, but over the last 50 years, it's been one-to-one. So think about that as a scenario. Think about that as anticipation. If we have $400 billion of crop and livestock revenue, how much will get spent on insurance? Well, about anywhere from $10 billion to $12 billion of that. Why? Because when you think about it, there's a ratio that runs over and over again. What's the concern right now? What we're hearing the concern is, wow, look how far down net farm income has gone. You know what the thing is that's most out of whack is with net farm income? Capital spending. They've put a lot of money into tractors, farm buildings, other things. It's not the misallocation of inputs. So when you talk to a farmer, it's always an interesting process. Like I said, they have a very poor concept of just the basic fundamentals of economics. And you say, who gets paid what? And why do they get paid that? Farmers love to moan and groan about Monsanto or crop inputs like fertilizer or machinery. They say it's too expensive. And my answer to them is, compare it to what? What are you comparing that to? Why do you say that? Well, all I know is it's too much. That's the answer I always get back from them. So let's talk a little bit about that. Who's making money in agriculture, and how is it getting spent? It's not surprising that things change over time. This is from the USDA. The USDA says, how do we spend money producing crops? And they break it into three mass categories, the ones I chose just for simplicity's sake. They roll up in different ways. Capital, labor, and intermediate factors. Who in this room ever had the misfortune of taking economics in their career? Anybody take economics? James, where are you? You took a lot of economics, right? We talk about that all the time. We talk about factor productivity, right? Remember that from your microeconomics? It's a classic. We talk about capital, labor, and intermediate factors. So it's not surprising that the USDA's economics group went back and said, what was it that we saw in agriculture? What do you notice about agriculture over the last 60-plus years? A phenomenal change. This is a time series chart. We're looking at some long-term trends. We went and saw agriculture flip from being a labor-intensive industry to being a technological-intensive industry. We took corn yield during this period from 40 bushels an acre to 160-plus bushels an acre in our industry. That wasn't because people got smarter and people got more productive in labor. That's not the case. They started bringing in more and more outside intermediate factors from high technology companies and applying them to their industry. Guess what? If Monsanto, John Deere, BASF, and crop insurance people bring you high-tech, high-value products, they want to get paid for them. So where is the money in agriculture? The money in agriculture is intermediate factors, crop chemical, fertilizer, machinery, seed technology, all those things. You look at this chart, what's going to be the most likely projection going forward? Intermediate factors will consume more and more of crop spending. Why? Because they're the avenue to better productivity. If you don't like it, get out of the industry. That's pretty much a pretty simple analysis. Has it had an impact? Absolutely. This is a very, very strong case for why we're doing so well in agriculture globally. This is the ratio of how much seed corn we use to how much seed corn we get. Final corn we get. Back in the 1970s, for every bushel of seed corn that we put into the system, we got back 300 bushels of corn. That's a great return. One bushel of corn gives you back 300. Today, it's over 600. Think about that. Why do we pay more and more to outside intermediate factors? because they're the technology changers. They're the ones that are driving the industry. What do we spend it on? This is where you get some interesting news when you think about things in a ratio. Another thing about systems is never get caught up in the absolute numbers, because absolute numbers can be done in all over the board. Ratios are usually a much better way to track a system. They're a much better behavior pattern to track. Here we have two things. We have manufactured inputs, and we have insurance premiums. This is total insurance premiums for people in agriculture, for crop production. 4% of their expenses are insurance premiums. Is that an overwhelming number? Is that a number that should be focused on immediately? No. Think about this in comparison. In comparison, manufactured inputs, things like crop chemical, fertilizer, machinery, 23-26% of their spending. More than 5-1. 6-1. So when I sit down and talk to farmers, I do that every single day of my life, they say, oh man, I'm getting killed by these interest rates. I'm getting killed by my crop insurance. I'm like, that's 12th or 13th on your list of spending. Well, why don't you go talk to your neighbor about that cash rent? Oh, I don't want to do that. That's an unpleasant conversation. I'd rather come in and kick my banker, right? Everybody feels justified kicking the banker. But is that where the money's at? You heard earlier, you know, Mary Kay, you still in the room? She said, Willie Sutton was famous. They said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Is the money for a farmer in crop insurance? No, it's not. Are you going to be successful in farming by somehow driving your insurance premium from 4% down to 3.5% or 2%? No, absolutely not. Success in farming is not about minimizing your minor expenses. It's about getting yield while not losing track of your major expenses. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about three things that are kind of macro drivers right now. Interest rates and exchange rates. December of 2015, the Federal Reserve raised Fed funds for the first time in 10 years. 10 years. It's been so extraordinary. I mean, when I started in the mid-80s, if somebody would have said, you're going to go 10 years without having an interest rate increase, it would have been insane. We've never seen that happen. Now we kind of just shrug our shoulders and take it for granted. But interest rates and exchange rates are very much interlinked. And it's not always about absolute interest rates either. It's about relative opportunity. We'll talk about that. What about China? Over the last 10 years, we've gone from China will consume everything at any given price to today where we're saying, well, we wonder what China's really going to buy and at what price they're going to buy it. And last, biofuels. As I alluded to earlier, the biggest single driver of opportunity in agriculture in the United States and globally was the linking of energy to agriculture. Problem is, who anticipated $28, $30 barrel crude oil 2 years ago? Let's talk about interest. Talk about exchange rates. This is another example of a time series chart. And just for a little bit of review, think about that. When you track something over time, there's really four things that you can see in a time series chart. You can see a trend, you can see cycles, you can see seasonality, and there's random noise. If you think about it, every time you see a time series chart, just check off those four boxes. Is there a trend? Is there a cycle? Is there seasonality? And is there random noise? Well, looking at this index of dollar strength over the last 40 plus years, the question is there really a trend? And the answer is hard to say. You could argue one way or the other, but I don't think the trend is the most pronounced thing in there. And that's a very interesting concept about exchange rates. If exchange rate manipulation was a way to make your country successful, it would have been done 1,000 years ago. But exchange rates have a feedback mechanism that might run years or decades, but you pay the price for manipulating a currency. The question is, who pays the price? So when you have a feedback mechanism that runs over multiple years or even decades, you get a chart like this. Long cyclical behavior. We can see high cycles, you know, in the mid-80s, in the late 1990s. And think about it, from 2001, 2002, we had a downward weakening dollar, which made a great environment for U.S. exporters, including agriculture. Last couple of years, in anticipation of stronger U.S. growth relative, not absolute, but relative to the competitors, we saw the dollar strengthen remarkably. And we had a real feedback mechanism go on in our world. Not everybody gets treated the same. Not everybody makes the same decisions. Top four markets for the United States, 55% of all of our agricultural exports go to four countries: Canada, Mexico, China, Hong Kong, and Japan. This is the dollar index from the USDA tracking those different currencies. What do you notice? They're not synchronized. They don't have the same story. They have different policies going on. For example, Abenomics out of Japan was, we will weaken the yen against the US dollar to help our exporters. Conversely, it's going to hurt the Japanese consumer. What has China done so far? China's an immense force in the global markets, and they run their currency exchange rate with the United States for their own benefit. You don't get mad about stuff like that. Self-interest is the basis of economics, but it has consequences for us. Has a big impact on us. Just going back to 2007, look at the weakening dollar phase and then look at the strengthening dollar phase that we've had already. Dramatic impact. China was growing. It had a strengthening currency against the U.S. dollar. It found a lot of U.S. agricultural products very appealing. Now we've seen a weakening Chinese currency, a weakening yen, Canadian dollar, and Mexican peso, and look at that flip in trade relationships. Year-to-date, or through 2015, we had an $18 billion trade deficit in agriculture with everybody else in the world, ROW, rest of the world. And our $22 billion surplus with China dropped to $16 billion. So you net those things together, we had the first negative trade balance in agriculture in about 8 years in this period. What's going to happen? Let me go back a couple slides here. Ask yourself the question, what's going to happen to the U.S. dollar going forward? Now, I always tell people my favorite two answers are, I don't know and I was wrong, okay? So my forecasts are not taken to the bank. But there's really three options when you look at this chart. The dollar can continue to strengthen some more, the dollar could plateau and go sideways, or the dollar could weaken. Pretty straightforward. But think about the scenarios and the impacts it's going to have on your business via agriculture. What's my guess? The dollar will continue to strengthen over the next 2 to 3 years. Marginally, but will continue to strengthen. Why? Because there's a lot of expressions that express, you know, weakness. But I'm going to use one that's polite in public. It's called the cleanest dirty shirt in the pile, right? People don't like our 2% GDP growth. They say, 2% real GDP growth is terrible. I guarantee you Japan would kill to have 2% real GDP growth right now. We're the cleanest dirty shirt in the global market today. People want to own dollars for one of those reasons. So think about the impact on us in agriculture. I tell farmers over and over again, when you produce a commodity that's shippable, there's only one price in the global market. If you remember your economics training, it's called the law of one price. James, remember that? The law of one price. Here's an example of the law of one price. New Zealand whole milk powder versus U.S. whole milk powder. They're not exactly the same, but clearly when you look at the cycles higher and lower, both markets need to move together because the global purchasers of whole milk powder shop around. You cannot avoid the global markets. So let's talk a little bit about that. Everybody thought China was going to be the driver of all these commodities forever. You know, shortage, always going to be in short supply, high prices. Not surprising, that was a poor forecast. What happened to our happy ending? Well, I think a lot of times we like to tell stories that we want to believe, not that we should believe. Did the relative competitiveness change? That's an interesting question for people in this room, because if you're invested in North American agriculture, specifically the United States, the real question is, are you getting better faster than your competition? It's pretty hard. We've set ourselves a real tough job here in the United States. Why? Because we're so good at what we do, it's easier to catch up than it is to get ahead. So relative competitiveness is also a key issue. And what about technological change? You know, people say, well, you know, they're not making any more farm ground. There's a lot of technological change that's still coming in the pipeline for the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. It takes a long time to get some of this stuff into the practice. So these are the trends. Once again, a time series chart. This is something that we look at a lot. On the left-hand side, we have global population. On the right-hand side, we have global GDP as best estimated by the USDA. And what do we think about it? Undeniable long-term positive trends. You would think, and this is what you hear all the time. In fact, I was just in southern Minnesota on Tuesday listening to a guy selling farm ground. He was a farmland broker. And what was the lead slide that he had on his farmland presentation? How many people will be in the world in 2050? What do you think the number was? You've seen that number, right? Come on. What are you, two vegans, too weak to answer? Come on. 9 billion, right? Isn't that the number we've heard endlessly? In 2050, we'll have 9 billion plus people to feed in this world. We're going to need to have higher crop prices to make that happen. That was his rationale to get those guys to buy more farm ground. They're not making any more farm ground. There's going to be more people to feed in 2050. You need to buy farm ground. I'm like, dude, come on. It's like serving booze to drunks, you know. That's what they want to hear from you. Where's your discipline in that? I mean, sure. But these dominant trends, population and GDP, mask some of the cycles that we have to deal with over time. What about China? You know, it's interesting. Chinese statistics are an interesting set of numbers, right? You take them with a grain of salt. But I guarantee you, when we peaked at $140 a barrel crude oil, we'd seen that trend from 2000 to 2007, where we saw ever-accelerating GDP growth out of China. Peaked and started to come down. Now, this is from the USDA's global forecast for Chinese growth, the top line there. This is their number. I said, well, what if it's even marginally weaker? What does that mean to us in agriculture? How much demand will there be? Big question. And who are we competing with? We produce, and there's a lot of farm ground in the world. This is a breakout of some of the major competitors out there. Thousands of hectares used for grain, including rice. And we get tied up in our world, but there's some things that do change over time. Former Soviet Union, the green line here, you can see clearly they lost ground over the last multiple decades. Who's been picking up ground? MENA plus. What's MENA? Middle East, North Africa, plus Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, there's an interesting question. Think about it. Where's the biggest source of population growth going to occur over the next 20 to 30 years? Africa. 80%+ of global population growth gain is going to be in Africa under the current projections. Where's the biggest source of untapped farm ground in the world? Africa, right? MENA plus. And how are they doing on yields? They got a long ways to go, and it can happen. Once again, the biggest source of population growth, biggest source of farm ground, that African grouping. But look how far below they are in terms of crop productivity. So do crop prices have to get higher? What do you hear a lot from farmers today? Corn needs to go back to $5. Corn needs to go back to $6, otherwise we won't be able to feed the world. Is that true? Probably not. I think there's a lot of opportunity in a lot of other markets to produce better yields. How much grain do we have? Well, you can see that the long-term trend in grain per person, grain per capita, really hasn't trended. A lot of noise, a lot of randomness in there. But some trend, no trend, and pretty much just random noise. You can see our droughts in North America. You can see droughts in other areas. But when you look at a chart like this, when you say, how much grain do we have per person, is it really changing over time? Not that much. Where have we really wanted to change the system? Oil seeds. Oil seeds equals protein. Evidently, when you look at the long-term trend for protein per person, the real driver of opportunity has been and will be how much soybean and soybean equivalent are we going to grow around the world market. So there is some good news. People want more protein. Diets do change. But even underneath that statement, there's another thing that pushes back on us. Like I said, people tell stories. That's what we do. We're good at telling stories. But what we're not good at thinking is, what's changing over 5 or 10 years? Here is an example of protein change. You got per capita on scaling, log 2 scaling, because every time you cross one of those lines, you've doubled. What do you notice? That we have a lot more pork and a lot more broilers, chickens, per person than we did 40, 50 years ago. But are the meat industry standing still? No. I was out in Willmar, Minnesota, which is a town of western Minnesota, last year at the Animal Science Conference. And there's a lot of poultry producers in there. And I was talking to the guys who grow the turkeys and the birds. And I said, how much more productivity do you have in those barns? You guys are really good at what you do already. They said, wow, We're competitive. Every day we're trying to get better. We think we have another 30, 40% productivity to gain in the next 5 to 10 years. This is from world-class competitors already. So think about what we're saying here. We got ample grain supplies, we're producing more oil seeds, and we're translating them through biology that's getting better and better. Do crop prices necessarily need to rise? My answer is no. Now, is that a bad statement for people in this room? Yeah, it puts a cap on some of the revenue that's going to be out there in the global market. But at the same time, I don't foresee prices dropping dramatically either. There's a step function that we see over time. Let's talk about that. Three things again. What's happening in ethanol? What are the ethanol producers doing about it? And what about technological change? What do we see? Let's start out with this chart. This is an interesting chart. The USDA tracks corn prices back to 1860, back to the Civil War, even pre-Civil War. It's not very often you get a time series that long for something that's comparable. Here's 100 years worth of data. Is that enough data to make a decision? In southern Minnesota, they said they wanted one more year. That's what they told me. They're going to make a decision next year after they get 101 years worth of decision. Now, it is interesting, my Uncle Phil, who's 96, so he's been here for most of this period, he still can't market corn. And he'll tell you he can't market corn. He's been marketing corn since he was 10 years old with my grandfather. He's had 86 years to practice marketing corn, and he's still a miserable seller of corn. So practice does not make perfect when it comes to things like this. But what do we see in this chart that should catch our attention? It's not a normal time series chart. Once again, a time series chart. But does it trend? I'm going to pick on you again, James, because you're the trained professional. Is this a normal trending chart in your mind? No. What do you kind of notice? I drew the step functions in there, but what do you notice about that?
I think we got some regime switching.
Regime switching. I like that. Typically, farmers don't tell me they see regime switching in this chart. So you're the first person to give me regime changing. It's interesting because we get flipping points where we knock ourselves out of the previous belief pattern. End of World War II, you know, oil crisis of the early 70s, biofuels of the mid-2000s. The worst thing that happened to us was we shot our grain prices up above $5 or $6 for 3 years. We convinced ourselves that that was the new normal. It's not the new normal. The new normal is probably $4, okay? $4, give or take, a wide range. But it has a big impact on us because if corn's the driver of soybeans, 2.5, driver of wheat, 1.5, the driver of cotton, soybean, peanuts, and all the other things, $4 is a number that we need to think about. How much revenue is in the industry and what's our share of that industry? Key question. Here's an exercise in humility. Anybody in this room enjoy forecasting oil prices? Because if you do, you must be a masochist, right? You know, think about that. Look at the volatility on this commodity just over the last, 10 years. We've had a high of 140, crashed back down to under 40, went back to 80 to 100, and now we're back at under 40 on West Texas Intermediate. Where's it going to be 5 years from now? I have absolutely no idea. I don't think it's going to stay as cheap as it is, but don't bet any money on that. I make a lot of investments. My favorite investment strategy is called catch the falling knife, okay? Anybody ever practice that as their investment strategy? You know, when a stock's gotten cheaper, you buy some, and then you wish you would have waited another 2 months, right? Catch the falling knife. Well, this is pretty much catch the falling knife in terms of asset values and this. Why does it matter to people in this room? Because if we don't see a substantial recovery in the value of crude oil, you can't run up the price of corn. If you can't run up the price of corn, you can't increase the price of soybeans. You can't increase the price of wheat. So what are we looking at here? You know, a little bit of recovery. This is employment on the left-hand side, labor force participation. Why does this chart matter to us? Because energy consumption is driven by, not surprisingly, economic opportunity. And what we also see is pretty stagnant gasoline demand, driven by pretty stagnant miles driven. So the question is, will we see higher crude oil, which will allow us to price up corn? We're just starting to see, after a prolonged period of time with no improvement in driving miles, some improvement. Time series chart. Let's go through our checklist. Is there a trend over the last 10 years? Not noticeable. Is there cyclicality? Somewhat. Not very impressive. Is there seasonality? Very impressive seasonality in this type of a market. Is there random noise? Yeah, plenty of it. So what does this mean? Back to the biofuels. Consuming 5.2 billion bushels of corn, the biggest single buyer of corn, the biggest driver of pricing. We have hit the legendary blend wall there. If you don't move up gasoline demand, you cannot move up ethanol demand. We've smacked into that blend wall at 10%. So unless we see crude oil demand get driven up, gasoline demand driven up by more miles, driven better economic performance, the ethanol industry has hit a plateau. And with the current pricing, that plateau is going to be very painful for them. This last week in Iowa, they were paying $3.50 per bushel of corn, cash price, total Iowa. That was about zero profits for them at the current ratio of ethanol distiller's grain for the inputs. They're in tough shape there. Without a major rally in energy, there's no rally possible in corn. I mean, and as it stands, the worst thing could happen to the farmer is what they want to have happen. They'd like to see the price of ethanol go up so they could pay more for corn. But unless you drive up the price of crude oil and gasoline, the premium that we see on ethanol above gasoline gets more and more out of whack. These are things that we track all the time. We look at premiums, we look at ratios, and we say to ourselves, don't ask for that. What would farmers like? They'd like to see higher corn prices. What would a farmer like? End the year at $5.50 corn or $6 corn, right? But can an ethanol plant pay $6 for a bushel of corn in a world where they're selling gasoline for a dollar? They could, because renewable fuel standards require them to blend 10% regardless of the value to the consumer. But if they do that and you start paying $2.50 for a gallon of ethanol when it's a gallon of gasoline is a buck, the consumer is going to hate your guts. And the worst thing that could happen to the farmer is for that to happen. They shouldn't ask for it. Right now, the ethanol guys are running their plants because they're too stupid to stop. And that's a serious comment. A lot of ethanol plants are run by farmer co-ops that have zero economic rationale. As long as there's cash in their statement, they're going to run that plant because they've been told to run that plant to support their members. Now, there are ethanol producers out there, majors, you know, run by the Koch brothers, run by, you know, ADM, they've shown some more rationality, but still we're producing way too much ethanol in this environment because there's no reason to be running ethanol plants at record levels because there's no profits in that margin. So let's finish up with the ethanol piece. Think about the linkages. Oil, gas, ethanol, corn, you. Corn is trapped by low oil. Until we see a major rally in crude oil, you really see poor valuations of corn into ethanol. And that's a big impact. So what happens this year if we do get a weather event and suddenly we think, well, we're going to be 5, 10, 15% short on corn production due to weather impacts? The market will rally. I'm not saying it wouldn't. But it will rally into the face of poor valuations for ethanol to gasoline that are already existing, making them even worse, which is going to paint a big bullseye on the back of the ethanol guys. They don't want that to happen. They want it to happen, but they shouldn't want it to happen. Protein exports are also hampered by that strong dollar. You know, the same thing that's driving, same connection point. And at the end of the day, there's nothing you can do about this. Someday, battery technology will kill the ethanol industry. I don't know when, but it's an ongoing technological battle between two things, corn yields and electronics. And so far, the electronic industry has always been able to out-increase the biological piece on an ongoing basis. Someday, the Teslas of the world will kill ethanol, because how much ethanol can you mandate for an electrical vehicle? Pretty hard, right? Just have them send a check to the ethanol plant, right? But someday, ethanol is going to get killed. It's not going to be in the next 5 years, but 10, 15 years out, you could see a big technological tipping point at some point. So with that, let me stop, because I don't want to run into lunchtime, right, Mike? Any questions, comments, complaints?
Got one back here.
Good.
Maybe more of a crystal ball story for 2016, but in your eyes, what do you see shaping up as maybe the big agricultural story globally for 2016?
Well, I think is, you know, the commodity retrenchment is already in play. The whole idea of what are commodities worth, whether it's metals, energy, or the softs, as we call them, I think we're just reevaluating that whole, you know, growing demand story. And I think a lot of people are going to really start to capitulate on that, at that story as we go through 2016. You know, they kind of told themselves a happy ever after story, and now they're running into the reality of the day-to-day life story. So I think that's going to be the capitulation of commodities, and we can't avoid it in the agricultural side either. A good question. Any other questions?
Got another one back here.
Okay.
Yes, Dr. Swanson, to kind of piggyback on that question there, if you could pick one volatility in the ag market in the next 12 months, what would you pick?
I think it's going to be weather, because I think it's going to take, you know, 6 to 12 to 18 months to really convince the world that you can't have $20, $30 barrel crude oil and get enough of it for future production. So I think that will be the next big one, but this year it will be a weather-driven market to the degree that it has to have some volatility. Or it's going to be a banking crisis. You pick the two, weather or banking, you know, we're pretty good at screwing up either one. Yes. Okay.
What would be a break-even price for ethanol? I mean, what the barrel, the oil barrel, would have to cost to make money?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. The question is, what's the break-even? And you never ask an economist what a break-even is, because they're going to come back and say, what are the conditions? But let's assume we have $30 barrel crude oil today. You know, a fair break-even in a traditional market would be corn under $3 per bushel. That would allow them enough margin to transform it into ethanol at a standard price, distiller's grain at a standard price, and make a profit. They need about corn to come down 50 cents to make their break-evens work in the ethanol transformation process.
Okay, maybe one more question. I mean, the politicians in U.S. and Europe, they more or less created the bubble for the corn price with the ethanol. Do you think there is a pressure for them to correct it again? As you said, the long-term expectation of the demand for ethanol is anyhow dwindling.
Right. You know, it's a good key question for policy, because they know what they did. They know that by creating the ethanol market, they introduced 5 billion new bushels of demand in a stagnant industry that put us short for that period of time until we caught up. Now, the problem is they have to live with Frankenstein's baby, okay? And Frankenstein's baby is they also had declining interest rates, so cheaper borrowing, more money in corn and crops. Suddenly, land values are very, very high in the Midwest. 85%+ of the farmer balance sheet is land value. And so anything they do that suddenly takes away that value creates an enormous pain in the industry, because debt is there, valuations go down because different expectations. Rising interest rates or falling crop prices. They don't want to have that crisis. So they're going to try to avoid it. The problem is that they force people to pay, like I said, $2 for ethanol when they can get gasoline for a dollar. All they're going to do is incent the anti-ethanol lobby to work even harder to blow up the whole thing. We saw a pretty interesting case of that. Ted Cruz, love him, loathe him, that's your business. He didn't support ethanol in Iowa, and yet he still picked up the most votes in their caucus system. That's something that the ethanol people in Iowa are finding almost unbelievable. And so the biggest thing they could do, problem they could have, like I said, is get ethanol high when gas is cheap and then expose themselves as being unfriendly to the consumer in general, and then enough congressmen and senators might vote to change the whole thing, and they have another pain point. Thank you.